You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science today, we're joined by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Welcome.
don't say that word, goodness. especially after last week or the week before.
Can't trust experts,
keep well away from them.
What has science got for us today?
Well, okay, so here's a question. How do we make energy? Because that is kind of important, isn't it? So, you know, the major ways that we make energy at the moment are, you know, like burning things. So you will burn fuel and then that will power a motor of some description and everything, and then you can do work and all that sort of stuff. Moving water, so letting water go through a turbine and everything, spinning a turbine, all of those sorts of things. Getting two metals with potential difference and then you link them with a wire and you get flow of electrons and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, that's how we make energy. But one of the ways that you wouldn't think of making energy is just by using ambient moisture in the air. You wouldn't think that would really go a long way, would you?
No, can't quite track that off the top of my head.
No, me neither. So how they got this idea, I have no idea, but there's some workers in the UK and Italy who have just published a paper in the journal Nano Energy, and what they have managed to make is a biodegradable, and that's really by the by in this case, because that's not the most impressive thing about it, biodegradable moisture energy generator, or otherwise known as a MEG, apparently. Okay.
Yeah.
A moisture energy generator. And they make this from things as simple as gelatin, okay, sodium chloride or table salt, and activated carbon, or basically charcoal. That's it.
Not a set of super rare.
No rare earths in there whatsoever. And this mixture somehow generates electricity using humidity in the air, which is quite remarkable.
Oh.
So how the heck does this work? Well, as much as I can understand it, and I'm no expert, so what they do is that they mix these three components in water and then they dry the whole thing out, okay? And it goes from this nice mixture where it's all sort of, everything's sort of nicely mixed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, when you dry this out, it undergoes a process called self-stratification, which in other words means that it orders itself into layers, okay? So it goes from this mixed state into sort of this stratified state, this layered state. And one of the layers is what we call hydrophilic. It means it likes water. And another layer is hydrophobic, okay, which means it hates water. And so essentially one side of the material likes water, the other side of the material hates water, and the bit in the middle is sort of easy-ozy sort of thing. And what this appears to do is that it can then absorb moisture from the air. So you expose it to humidity, and then as soon as you do that, what that then allows is movement of ions. So ions are anything that's got a charge. Mm. So we've got table salt in there, okay? Table salt is made of ions. It's made up of positively charged sodium ions and negatively charged chloride ions, okay? And if you can allow these to move, then what can happen is that you can induce movement of electrons, okay? And as you hopefully know, movement of electrons is basically an electric current,
yeah.
Okay? So if you've got these positive ions that are moving, then they have to be balanced somehow, okay? And they can be balanced by the movement of electrons. So the movement of positive charge away can be balanced by the movement of electrons in the opposite direction, and there you have yourself a little electrical circuit, essentially, and a flow of electrons, so you get electric current. And so they've been playing around with this. As I say, they've just published it, and they can get a potential difference of 1 volt, which, you know, doesn't sound like very much, but hell, you know, considering what they're using.
Yeah, from three things that you could find in an aisle at a supermarket.
Yep, basically. And so they can maintain that potential difference of a volt for around about 30 days, they say. So, you know, this stuff is fairly robust. And what you can then do, like anything, you can connect them in series and then the voltage increases, okay, when you connect things in series. So they can get up to about 90 volts potential difference and 5 milliamps current. And that is enough to power things like small LEDs and stuff like that, a string of LEDs and stuff. So this just sort of boggles the mind, really, that you can take such simple ingredients and just mix them up, and then all of a sudden all that it's doing is absorbing moisture from the air and generating an electric current. What the hell?
Yeah, it's like it's one of those things that, like, going back to my casting my mind back to high school chemistry classes, right, where I'm like, yeah, I guess that works, but it's still like, how did we get here?
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, how they managed to sort of come up with that particular combination of things. Obviously, there's a lot of thought gone into it. It's not just some random something. But, you know, it really is quite remarkable that I remember talking on the show, oh, gosh, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago now, about a similar sort of thing where you could generate electricity from water going down very, very narrow tubes.
Oh.
And a similar sort of thing. So there's all... excuse the pun, potential sources of energy out there that, you know, maybe we just haven't even thought about yet, haven't even contemplated because it sounds too bizarre. Mm. But, you know, this goes to show that maybe, you know, nothing is too bizarre. So, you know, watch the space on this one. This is quite incredible.
Fun time.
Yeah.
What else do you have for us today?
Bananas.
I don't like bananas.
What?
That's my
wow.
Brave take.
Goodness me.
No.
Wow.
Never been a banana guy.
Wow. Okay. I'm. You've got to be the first, I think. Everyone likes bananas except Alex. There we go. Liam, you're bananas?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Oh, there we go. Yes.
Bananas.
Yes. So we all know that bananas are natural and that they're really good for you and that they are, you know, an absolutely vital ingredient in your smoothies, aren't they? They absolutely are. Nothing
can't have a smoothie without them.
Nothing like a good banana smoothie, okay? And so that was sort of the received wisdom, I guess. And so some folk in the States decided to, as you do, test such things. Never assume. And they found some very interesting results, let's say. So we need to delve into a little bit of chemistry to discuss this. So we're going to talk about molecules called flavonoids. Flavonoids, okay? So they are linked to good health. They are good molecules. We want as many of those as we can get. So they're linked to heart health. They're linked to cognitive health. They're just good for you, okay? And so you want to be chowing down on anything that contains these, okay? So in other words, apples, pears, blueberries, blackberries, grapes, those sorts of things, okay? Just the sort of things that you might find yourself throwing in a bit of a smoothie, maybe, okay? So that's all good. So if you make your smoothie out of those, then you're going to be getting a good dose of flavonoids. However, don't be too tempted to chuck in a banana on top of them, okay? Oh. Because bananas contain an enzyme, and an enzyme is just a big, big molecule that carries out a particular process very, very specifically, and it's called polyphenol oxidase, okay? And the thing about enzymes, the names sort of do what they say on the tin. So this oxidizes polyphenols, okay? Yeah, polyphenol oxidizes molecules called polyphenols. What are polyphenols? Well, they are, the enzyme comes into action like when you bruise a fruit or something like that and it goes brown. That's your polyphenol oxidase in work, okay, in operation. And so this enzyme goes for these polyphenol molecules. Now, flavonoids just happen to be a subclass of polyphenols, okay? So what these workers did, they said, okay, well, you know, these bananas, they've got this enzyme that might sort of undo all the good flavonoids that are in your smoothie if you go and throw bananas in with your smoothie on top of your apples and your grapes and blah, 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 blah. So what they did say, they monitored flavonol levels from a bunch of volunteers in blood and urine after consuming either a banana smoothie or a berry smoothie, as well as a flavonoid capsule, okay? So they're taking their flavonols, following it down with either a banana smoothie or the berry smoothie, and then measuring the flavonol levels in your blood and your urine. And what they found was that after your banana smoothie, those that had the banana smoothie and then the flavonol, 84% lower amount of flavanol compared with if you just had your berry smoothie by itself. Okay?
Which isn't an insignificant...
That's not an insignificant, yeah. Okay? So it looks like throwing in a banana into a berry smoothie is sort of undoing a lot of the good that the berry smoothie was going to do you, which is not to say, for goodness sake, don't eat bananas like Alex. Otherwise you end up like Alex, you know. So, you know, bananas are good for you. They are absolutely, definitely, definitely good for you. But maybe... might be best not to mix them with those sort of berry-type fruits, those high flavanol fruits.
Okay? Have a banana after your smoothie.
yeah, basically, okay? So I think that's a very, very interesting finding, yeah. But I'm not trying to dissuade people from eating bananas. But fascinating stuff. So it goes to show that, you know, mixing foods and stuff like that, you do have interactions between the molecules in different foods.
There's chemistry going on, right?
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, there's chemistry going on everywhere.
Well,
Alex.
Like, obviously,
goodness.
But I mean, like, it's just. of course, things happen.
It's ubiquitous. It's totally ubiquitous. But I think that's a very, very interesting finding. And I think the mainstream media are going to pick that up, I think, because it's a good story.
It's nice and relatable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, interesting stuff.
And what do you have for us last?
Oh, sheesh. Well, controversial. Controversial. Okay. Solar geoengineering. Now, I don't you two are too young to remember the great days of the original Simpsons in the 90s.
Yes.
And when Mr. Burns shut out the sun on Springfield. No, you don't remember.
No, I wasn't allowed to watch Simpsons.
You've got so much to look forward to. The 90s Simpsons the first 10 seasons are just brilliant. So, solar geoengineering, right, we all know that we are living on a warming planet, and it's probably not the best. And so what can we do to stop that warming? God forbid that we stop using fossil fuels or anything like that.
Of course, that would be ridiculous.
That would be ridiculous. So why don't we then just try and block the sun out? You know, there's a better idea, isn't it? Okay. So there is an Israeli company called Stardust Solutions who are proposing this. And they have got 75 million seed funding and they've got a patent application and stuff. They've been doing lab tests, and what they are looking at is a mixture of amorphous silica, which is basically sand, pretty much, same sort of thing, and calcium carbonate, which is basically eggshells. And so their plan is to crush this up really, really, really finely into a very, very fine sort of dust and everything, and then you release it in the upper atmosphere, okay? And then this will actually reflect back a certain amount of solar radiation. Okay, you're both sort of giving me the same face there.
It seems like a really roundabout way of just putting mirrors in the sky.
Yeah, so let's talk ethics here, because, you know, who thinks this is a great idea? I mean, this is just tinkering around with the most precious resource that we've got, which is basically, you know, our atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And you want to get stuck into that, and you could precipitate uncontrolled change in the weather patterns or whatever. Nobody knows. Nobody has the slightest idea what this would do, whether it would be good, whether it would be terrible. And I'm not sure we should even be looking at this. I mean, there are plenty of mitigating factors that we could utilize, and this would be, in my view, a very, very, very last resort. But
yeah, it feels like focusing on how can we make the sun hit less is maybe a couple steps down of how can we make it so the atmosphere that we have is not.
There we go. They're out of the mouths of babes. There we go. Honestly, you know.
Yeah, it's just. Oh god.
So, but again, having said that, we've kind of been doing the same thing incrementally for years. We've been pumping stuff into the atmosphere and pumping and pumping, and that's why we've had the warming. You know, that's why things are not looking so great. So. We can't be too smug about this, possibly, but I'm not sure that this is the actual best solution. I think there are plenty of other things that we could and should be doing way, way before even contemplating anything like this. It's, you know, it's an experiment on the earth. Mm-hmm. It's an experiment on humanity, essentially. And I don't think we're quite ready for that yet. I don't think things have got that bad yet.
Yeah. Feels like a little bit of a... Maybe the wrong thing to be looking at right now. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a reasonable way of saying it. Yes. So again, it'll be interesting to see how far they get with this. I mean, 75 million sounds like a lot in seed funding, but really, in terms of science, it's, you know, dare I say it, a drop in the bucket. It will be interesting to see how this goes, because, you know, ordinarily, something like this is sort of confined to a single country, you know. But this is not. This is going to be the entire planet. This is a global experiment. And mm-hmm. who's in charge of the global experiments? Who makes the ethical, decisions for global experiments? There's a question to finish on. Yeah.
Nice we'll leave existential that one hanging. for the end of our segment. Well,
indeed.
Thanks, Alan, for joining us. Thank you, Motat, and thank you, Science. Motat After Dark, enjoy Beats, Eats, and Collection Treats after hours, 4th to 6th of June. Book now at motat.nz.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.